Thank you very much for acknowledging that we shall be up 10. It's very nice to be back to Rutherford Appleton Laboratory again after 20 years or so. It's great to see a couple of familiar faces and plenty of new ones as well, so thank everyone for coming. I joined my Rutherford postdoc spanned about 10 years altogether. I was working in experiments, and so I'll explain a bit about how I transitioned to working to this role, theoretical project as I go along. I should explain the title before I start. So the question mark on unification is partly because everybody thinks it's an important question. You can always just see the world as a series of models that we apply to different aspects of things we see in experiments. Others believe there should be some unified theory, has a more embracing description of all of our current observations. Also, if you believe in some form of unification, this question, what did it apply to? What does it mean? And then whether it's possible or not, is it something simple? Is it going to be too complicated, something beyond us? Second part of the title also has a kind of double meaning. It's kind of my answer to the first part in that it is a matter of time. It suggests it's something simple, something attainable. And the key will be something in the nature of time itself will be the key to this kind of unification program I'll describe. So during the talk, I'll try to make this case rather than building unification based on a particular form of matter, or actually no matter in the space, but focus on the form of time instead. So let me just first of all say what I mean by unification to get everyone on the same page. So I'm thinking of something that's quite simple, something unique, could be a simple entity or concept or math structure. If it is a simple entity or concept, it should have, of course, a mathematical description to develop it into a form of theory. And this development of this mathematical structure should be able to account for fermionic multiple structures. I'm thinking three generations of leptons and quarks with the gauge structure, and ideally eventually massive encouplings, 20 or 25 parameters we measure, standard model and neutrino massive mixing as well. And also account for unifying quantum theory of gravity. It's a unified framework that both works for gravity and quantum theory. And ideally, we'd like to incorporate something about cosmology to account for large-scale observations. So some dark sector, dark matter, dark energy, and the universe, and maybe put it all together in kind of a big picture with questions of the origins in general and before the Big Bang. So people often work on these three things independently, and there can be unification programs which are based more on just grand unified theories, for example, or just amalgamating quantum theory of the gravity, or even a unified dark sector. But if we're looking for an overall unified program, there are also questions in each of these things we might want to understand better, like, for example, the Higgs and neutrino sector in the model, or problems in quantum mechanics like the measurement problem, or making singularities, and addressing things like tensions in cosmological models. So there are things in these existing areas that we'd like to understand more. And one area which strikes me as kind of neglected in these kind of outline of what we're looking for is unification, is kind of the nature of unification itself, kind of questioning the foundations of unification, how we go about constructing a theory, rather than tend to just apply similar kind of ideas like supersymmetry or extraspatial dimensions. So this slide was intended to kind of transit to an outline of the talk, which kind of more or less does, but I won't talk about all of these things in the context of this new approach. But I will talk a lot about using time rather than matter or space, or extra-dimensional space, as a basic entity. And this takes a mathematical form of generalizing proper time. I'll describe how it very directly connects with certain mathematical structures which are very unsuitable for describing standard model multiple-type structures. I'll then lead up to introducing how it connects with a framework for unifying quantum theory with gravity. I won't go into any detail on that at the talk. And I'll also lead up to describing and briefly describe how these two actually candidates for dark matter and dark energy and the early universe structure formation. And basically, when I get there, I'll kind of get to the summary. So I'll mainly talk about the first point at the top, and I'll keep coming back to this basic idea. And then I'll link it mainly with standard models and with cosmology, and mention a few things about quantum gravity as well in between. And I will keep coming back to the basic idea. But let me just introduce this basic idea, and I'll take a kind of sorry, called run up to this idea. In terms of relations between space, time, and matter, in theories that we're familiar with, they're going back to classical physics, which had treat absolute time and space as two independent things, as like stage on which we include matter. In the case of classical physics, in terms of particles, impenetrable, tiny solid bodies. And then the special relativity introduces proper time, where these are general finite kind of intervals of space and time, and they come together in this quadratic form with a Lorentz symmetry, which leaves invariant proper time on the left hand side. So now we have the space time form, and in this arena, matter can be particles and fields. In fact, special relativity in 1905 was motivated as a more consistent framework for Maxwell's equations, which transform in a covariant manner between different Lorentz frames. Then, sticking with this this Lorentz form for proper time, in general relativity, this now only applies at the purely local level. So, in general relativity, in the larger space time, there's a curved space time structure. So, locally, we still have this one dimensional space time Lorentz form, and that is still in the form of particles and fields. And then going to extra spatial dimensions, and these additional components are on the right hand side. And the idea is that in this augmented space time form, now the Lorentz symmetry is extended to some kind of n dimensional space times in SO1. And this here is an n dimensional space time symmetry. And the idea of having extra spatial dimensions is that matter will somehow be associated with these extra components, or their symmetries, or the metric geometry. Somehow these extra components will give us a source of matter in this original form of space-time. Now, going from special relativity, relativity to extra spatial dimensions, the Lorentz metric, and I'll often write this expression here for proper time in the summary form using this Lorentz metric down here. To go into extra spatial dimensions, rather summing over four components, and now sum over n components, so the metric is kind of extended out. So briefly, the idea of generalizing proper time is not to take this quadratic form with extra components, but rather to generalize further and go to a power of p. So not just quadratic, but cubic, quartic, higher order forms. So this will be our generalized form for proper time. These alpha coefficients are just generalizing these metric plus or minus ones and zeros. But now it's in a general non-quadratic form. And we're again summing over n components, but now, as I say, going to a power p. And this will have a larger symmetry. It won't be a Lorentz type symmetry, it'll be a larger symmetry, but it will still embed four dimensional space time Lorentz symmetry. So we're still going to pull out our four dimensional local space time part. Now, not as added to our extra spatial dimensions, but as a kind of a factor in what this term here. So there'll be the four dimensional space time part, so the quadratic part, will be multiplied by some other delta x's that make this up to a pth order polynomial. And there'll be the extra bits, the further kind of pth order parts that make up this full expression here. So we're still pulling out four dimensional space time, but the extra components now make up the basis for matter have this different kind of form. So we're going beyond four dimensional space time, but unlike extra spatial dimensions, we're allowing for powers beyond just quadratic order. When we pull out the Lorentz symmetry, this will break the symmetry, the full symmetry down to the Lorentz, and this will leave behind an internal gauge symmetry for the theory and for the physics. Okay, so let me just simplify this slide. Let me just say a little bit about how and why, as an experimentalist, I started to think about this. So when you're an experimentalist, you hear quite a lot. In the 90s, you heard a lot about theories of extra-spatial dimensions. And we know about Kluze-Klein theory with five-dimensional space-time. And then we also hear about string theory, which works in 10, 11, or 26 dimensions. But when you're a naive experimentalist thinking about this, you think, why should you have 10 or 11, 26? If you're going to add extra spatial dimensions, why do you stop? Why not keep adding them until you have an infinite number? So that was the original kind of thought on this. And any kind of infinity is quite a dizzying thought. So if you imagine one spatial dimension, you've got the right angles until then a third. And you can't picture a fourth, but you get the idea that you've got right angles again. And you keep going in your mind, adding on these extra spatial dimensions, but trying to conceive of infinity, it's like traveling a rock in a rocket at an infinite distance across space. You can imagine going beyond the solar system, beyond the galaxy, the edge of the visible universe, but going an infinite distance, even when you've gone a million times further than the visible universe, you haven't even got started in going to infinity. And here, in adding on extra spatial dimensions, you're adding infinity, that this list would go on across the screen and up to infinity. However, in the case of adding extra spatial dimensions, when this thing n goes to infinity, this is still a symmetry. There's a symmetry that could leave this little thing on the left-hand side invariant. But this thing is still invariant even when you go to a very large number of spatial dimensions. So the same way in our four-dimensional space-time, we're drifting through our four-dimensional space-time, the time we measure is just this time on the left-hand side, this thing that clocks measure its proper time experience. So even in an infinite dimensional space, despite this dizzy perspecting of all these extra dimensions, you can still hang on to this idea of proper time. This is just a real number. So clinging on to this real number, we can add it, as we do, say, in Newtonian physics, where we just add it as an absolute parameter. But we're already writing it in a quadratic form in relativity, which is kind of a strange thing to do with time already, to write it in a quadratic form. But it's just a real number, so we can write it as a cubic or quartic, any number we want to, as we do down here. On the right-hand side, there's no reason why matter should be quadratic, because there's nothing quadratic about matter. That's free to have any kind of mathematical structure here. The only part we have to least be quadratic is the space-time part. We can still pull that out. So that was the kind of argument for losing this unnecessarily restrictive assumption of singing quadratic form in spatial dimensions. This is possibly a bit unfamiliar. So on the next slide, I'll give an example of a cubic form for proper time. And I'll say how very directly, when you drop this assumption and go to this higher order form, this does directly lead to structures which resemble standard model type structures. Okay, so let me just summarize a little bit this. So basically, we think of going from classical physics to special relativity when an equal sign in equations of physics can carry a lot of weight sometimes. And really, when we think of this in relativity, we might think of it as going from right to left, because we know about coordinates already. We put them together in the left-hand side. Here, via this thought about infinite dimensional space-time, clinging on to this on the left-hand side, we're focusing more I'm thinking of this as an expression for this time interval. So we're going more the other way from left to right, thinking of this as an expression for time. So just to summarize this, in classical physics, space, time, matter, three independent things. Special relativity, space, time is now lumped together as unifying and constantly space, time, matter, particles and fields in that space, time. In general relativity, in the extended space, time, we've got Einstein's field equation, which links the space-time geometry with the presence of matter. So you already have this kind of overlap between space-time and matter. And the space-time geometry is now describing the gravitational field. So the motivation originally for Clusius Klein was if space-time geometry is describing the gravitational field, if we generalize that geometry, maybe we can incorporate the electromagnetic field. So the ultimate aim, extra spatial dimension, is to incorporate matter into our space-time structure. So this final step here is to not start with space-time, but to shift focus to the left-hand side and to start with time. So we're dragging out the components of space and matter out of time in this more unifying kind of picture. There's a kind of a progression here. There's a further step along this trajectory. So we're kind of examining this motivation. We don't need a quadratic form for matter when we're augmenting our space-time form. As I'll try to argue, it's simpler, more unique, more unifying. It's more conservative because we're starting with time. It's something we're very familiar with. It's very fundamental in physics. All of our equations of physics require an independent time parameter to do dynamics. It's also more direct. The direct symmetry breaking properties will give us the properties of physics. So it's possibly the simplest unifying relation between space, time, and matter. This is the kind of starting kind of motivation for looking at this approach. So let me describe. Yes, how we get to say a quadratic, say a cubic form from a quadratic form. Right, so we want to get to something higher order powers for proper time from this quadratic structure. So the next two slides are possibly the most technical mathematically, but they're not needed in detail for the rest of the talk. I just want to show a little bit about how to build a theory from this structure. So this quadratic form, in a well-known way, it can be written as a determinant of a 2x2 matrix to these 2x2 complex submission matrices. If you write out the determinant, you get this quadratic form here, and the Lorentz symmetry is now replaced by, well, it becomes this two by two unit determinant complex matrices that multiply into this matrix in a certain way that preserves the determinant. So once we've got a determinant form, we can recognize that two by two determinant embeds in a three by three matrix determinant in a very kind of standard way. So we can embed the two by two part in the top here. And now we have a three by three form, cubic form for proper time. So these are now matrices of three by three complex emission matrices, and it simply goes from SL2C to SL3C. And when we write out a kind of standard cofactor expansion of a three by three matrix, for example, get the determinant of this top part multiplied by this delta x8 here, and then we get these other cross terms, which are the other kind of parts of the cofactor expansion. The way I've written this is what I had on the first earlier slide. We're having generalized proper time in general. We're pulling out a quadratic part here, four-dimensional space-time, which is now a factor in one term, here with a single parameter delta x8, and the various of the cross terms at the end. Just an example of how we can pull out a quadratic form of space-time, and say a cubic form. But the question will be, if we're using this four-dimensional part here as our space-time, and these extra bits will be matter, and what do these kind of matter components look like? So in this case, we start off with nine components with this full symmetry. When we pull out four of them for our external space-time, this will break the symmetry, and we find that we get an SL2 symmetry, which is just our Lorentz symmetry we started with. And we now pull out an internal leftover part, which is a U1 symmetry, just find it in the mathematics. So if we look at this cubic form, this block form like this, and these are these delta x4 external components, with a two-component complex, two-dimensional vector over complex numbers, this psi, now delta x8. And these will be our kind of basis for matter. These are the kind of extra bits that shave off in pulling out our kind of four-dimensional space-time part. If you look at how these things transform under this broken symmetry, and this is the original kind of external vector, delta x8 is just a neutral scalar. And this doublet here, this psi comes in here. This transforms as a left or right-handed file spinner of unit charge. This is always already a little bit encouraging in terms of standard model structures, because if you look at the standard model, we do have things that transform under electromagnetic or hypercharged U1 type symmetries, and we get Dirac spinners of charged leptons and quarks, which are made up of left and right bar spinners. So we already get a little tiny piece standard model-like structure when we do this kind of cubic generalization of proper time. So the question will be that when we go to higher more components, higher order forms of proper time, will this start to look more like the standard model or less like the standard model? So I'll show the same table in a couple of slides' time for a 56 component form, rather 9 component form for proper time. And the question will be whether it starts to look more like the standard model. But how to get this 56 components is quite technical. I'll summarize it here. So we went from 2 by 2 matrix to 3 by 3. We can also augment complex numbers by replacing them with octonions. And don't worry if you're not familiar with these. I'll just briefly say the direct generalization of complex numbers is 7 imaginary units. So a complex number has a real and imaginary part. Quaternions, which might be familiar, have 3 imaginary units, and octonions have 7 imaginary units. And these don't have too many applications in physics, which is why they might not be quite so familiar. But they do still have a norm that you can define on them by multiplying one into its conjugate, which is where you negate all the imaginary parts and they have an inverse. And this norm is preserved by multiplication, as it is for complex numbers, which means you can describe symmetry transformations with these octonions. You have to be careful, though, because in general, they're not associative. So when you multiply a string of them together, it matters where you put the brackets. This is unlike, for example, a matrix algebra, where you could re-bracket things in different ways. But even despite its non-associativity, you can still form this determinant structure for a cubic form for proper time and have this SL3O action on them. And it turned out that this symmetry is equivalent to E6, and this E6 is one of what's called the five exceptional E groups. So this gives us a connection with E6. Again, don't worry about the technicalities. I'll summarize why this is relevant in a moment. It turns out another step up in technicality that this E6 symmetry of this cubic form for proper time embeds directly in the E7 symmetry acting on a 56. This is the 56 I mentioned earlier, an aquatic bob at proper time in this thing called the Fordham triple system, which is just a technical name. But this object, which now gives two copies of this 3x3 Octonian emission matrices and a couple of other real components. So the point I want to make is that by using this generalization from quadratic to cubic and quartic proper time, we get this direct connection with exceptional Lie groups here, E6 and E7. It's been known since the 70s that if you look at ground unified theories, starting with SU5 in 1974, SO10, there are also models in the 1970s with E6 and E7 out for E8. So it's well known that E6 and E7, E8 have well-known connections with standard model from the symmetry breaking structures, as do the Octonians in more recent studies. So this the mathematical structure of generalizing proper time directly connects the mathematical structures which are known connect to the Octonians. And slight differences for grand unified theories, they're just internal symmetries only, whereas we're here we're pulling out the Lorentz groups, we've also got the external symmetry. The symmetry breaking pattern is different, but still we might expect to see something that resembles the standard model. So I'm basically just going to show the result now, what happens for E7. So on the previous slide, I showed it for this nine component form, where these two components here transformed as a vial spinner, which is trodden for U1. And the question is now we're now augmenting this to these 56 components. What does it look like under the symmetry breaking? And I'm going to put this quartic form for proper time on these 56 components. We're going to again pull out just our four components for external space time. Now we find, as well as the Lorentz symmetry, we've also got, as well as our U1 internal symmetry, we've also pulled out an SU3 symmetry. When we look at how these 56 components collectively transform under this broken symmetry, we get a table that looks like this. This is our original four components, this is our external vector. But out of the other 52 components, we find that there are Dirac-like spinners transforming as singlets and triplets under the SU3. And writing down charge magnitude, we get this fractional charge structure like this. So if we're looking for structures that look like standard model, we see a resemblance here with electron-like and d-quark-like structures. I've written in u-quarks and neutrinos in inverted commas because they don't have the right Lorentz spin structure. But this table is very rich in standard model-like structures. We get things like SU3, singlets and triplets, and fractional charges for these Lorentz spin structures. And there are also details of electroweak symmetry breaking that are written in this table. So these components here behave a lot like Higgs components if we take the scalar magnitude of the external four vector. And that's because if we cover up this Lorentz group and don't ignore it for a moment, we can construct something like a grand unified theory just based on an internal symmetry part. And there we can add to this SU3, kind of internal SU2 cross U1. And if we look at the kind of electroweak symmetry breaking that's implied by this, then it turns out that these components behave a little bit like the Higgs in the standard model to break this symmetry down to this U1 that we see here. But we can't do this at the same time as having Lorentz symmetry. So things are kind of scrunched up a little bit too tightly. But that's not really the point. The point is that these symmetry breaking structures are extremely rich in standard model-like structures coming directly from generalizing proper time through to this quartic order. So this is incomplete and there are discrepancies, but these things do come out very directly, much more so than with extra spatial dimensions. So we need to go to a higher order for generalized proper time, and in particular, we're going to need these full spinner structures, a full electroweak theory, and three generations. And this leads to a prediction for something like E8 as the largest exceptional Lie group on at least a quintic form, possibly an octic form, for the source on the model. So that's a kind of prediction of the theory. Just to mention that possible complaints about this are that this isn't exactly one generation, it doesn't quite work. But I would say that if there is a fuller symmetry that gives you the full three generation picture, and you pull out a fraction of it, you don't necessarily expect to find one pristine generation. For one thing, there's no such thing as a pristine generation in nature because of mixing between the neutrinos and between the quarks. So pulling out one sort of action of this, you would expect to find some model structures, but not pristine generations. So this is quite, I don't think this problem, this doesn't look exactly like one generation. Another thing is that E8 doesn't work when you do the basic Lie group analysis, but this is a kind of Octonian construction, which has this non-associative property. And the third possible complaint is that we're putting them together in a unifying symmetry with the Lorentz group. Now, if you put your Lorentz group and gauge groups together in a larger group and call that a symmetry of your physics, then by the Kolmogorov Mandula theorem, you get trivial scattering matrices, and that's really what we see. But here we're starting with the larger symmetry, and we have to break this symmetry absolutely to pull out our four-dimensional space-time. But it's the broken structure, which is the symmetry of the physics. So I've written these just for completeness in slides, these 3 points, just to mention that for E8, when you get a standard group theory thing, then there's an associativity axiom for your group composition, which is not satisfied by the Octonians. This is why Octonians can give you non-standard representations. I mean, E8 is a complicated structure, even without doing this. Recently, my former Rutherford and Oxford colleagues, Ben and Claire, have been doing some work on an E8 structure. It's a very complicated business. I find this E8 optic structure. It's a bit like a kind of a giant Rubik's Cube type puzzle, because it's not just you can build this thing up in stages, it's both algebraic facets that all have to come together at the same time. I'm very pleased somebody's remembered that. Yeah, thanks. So that's a kind of, but the difficulties of this, I think, makes the first, what to me is the first prediction of the theory non-trivial, and that is that there is some kind of Octonian-based E8 symmetry to complete the small standard model structure. Physics predictions are a bit harder to come by for the beyond standard model, because you need this E8 structure. And I should mention is that most theories have a beyond standard model prediction, usually by adding something onto the standard model and taking the standard model as existing and then adding on some fields and so on. Here we're trying to build things up from the most elementary level and reconstruct the standard model and then in turn see what comes out beyond that. So, but we can look ahead to see where that beyond standard model physics might be. Certainly E8 would be big enough for there to be new gauge symmetries or new states in the symmetry breaking. But already at E7 there's a basis for left-right asymmetry, which I'll explain in kind of a cartoon form in these slides. So E6 is only 27 components. It's even more squashed up than E7. So one of the big puzzles at E6 was that the place where you'd like to put the neutrinos in the components was the same place where you'd like to put the Higgs, a big puzzle for a while. Then in going to E7, this had the same 27 components, but also its complex conjugate. And that introduces left and right-handed sectors. That opened up this thing into two separate sectors. So it priced apart this neutrino sector and the Higgs sector. And because the Higgs is associated with the Higgs symbol components, which we now have to insert either in the left or the right-handed sector, this breaks the left-right symmetry at this E7 level. So the Higgs seems to be sitting there where you'd want to put the right-handed neutrino, which suggests that in projecting forward what this E8 structure would look like, you'll still have the Higgs somewhere in the right-handed neutrino sector. So there's a very strong suggestion here that the Higgs is going to be somehow a composite of right-handed neutrino states. And I've drawn this in a deliberately kind of seesaw kind of fashion, with the Higgs kind of weighing down all on the right-handed neutrino side. So this was written in a paper a few years ago, comparing some models with two right-handed neutrinos. So in principle, from first principles, it strongly suggests that the theory would only have two right-handed neutrinos, and then the Higgs kind of somehow being composite of the third right-handed neutrino with some other degrees of freedom. So that's the area where new physics is quite likely coming from this this approach. Okay, so let me move on a little bit. So this was about standard model. How does gravity fit in with this? So normally in general relativity, we start off with flat space-time, and then we use this general metric structure to describe the gravitational field in the four-dimensional space-time. But we still have the local inertial reference frames, so with Lorentz metric here. So on the other side of this, this new theory is generalizing proper time, but just so at the local level. And these are kind of complementary generalizations globally or locally, but they still, idea of leaving proper time invariant is central to the theory. Here it's on the general coordinate transformations, and here it's on the general transformations of these, or local symmetry transformations of these components, where we pull out the Lorentz symmetry, the local inertial reference frame, and that leaves these residual components, which would be our matter components in space-time. So in the 1930s, Einstein famously expressed this satisfaction of the field equation relating the geometry of a space-time, which is this Einstein tensor, which is a function of derivatives in the metric, equating it with the energy momentum tensor, saying that I marvel the differential geometry on this side is perfectly known, whereas on the right-hand side, energy momentum is like a phenomenological model that we put in there to model what we know about matter. So it's kind of dissatisfying. So his motivation for unified field theory was to try to incorporate the wood on the right-hand side by augmenting the geometry, in particular this metric tensor on the left-hand side. So the approach I have here is not to augment this geometry, but to augment this geometry, just the local geometry, and use these components as the basis for the kind of energy momentum on the right-hand side. There's a natural progression here from time as a linear thing to a quadratic form. It needs to be quadratic to include space-time because spatial geometry has a quadratic form, and then onto higher-order forms to include space-time and also matter. And again, you can drop this assumption of being quadratic, because there's nothing quadratic about incorporating structures that matter. This is a kind of an aside. when you look at the standard model symmetry breaking structures here, as I mentioned, these external components are closely connected with the Higgs through the scalar field here. We can rearrange this equation, and so the proper time has a scaling in these local coordinates because of this kind of the fact that this is embedded in this larger structure. So if we try to write this geometry as close as we can, in Hopsley flat space time, then we get this small kind of perturbation. Basically means that we can write it as a flat space time, but it's scaled by what we're calling the Higgs field now, this scaling of this four dimensional space time part. So variations of what we're calling the Higgs field is going to directly warp the local space time geometry and lead to local time dilation effects. So the Higgs is directly connected to the Einstein tensor now with this warping of the geometry. And we're reading the Einstein equation from left to right as being, this is a property of matter that the space-time is curved. So that any kind of field that interacts with these external space-time Higgs components will perturb the geometry. There's a direct link here between the notion of mass in general relativity, which is connected to space-time curvature, space-time warping, and the Higgs field in the standard model, but they're normally two separate things. Okay, just say so this fits in very well with general relativity. We can just kind of implant this graph this locally in. But we're trying to build the theory here just from the basis in time. So the question is, if we're starting with time as a basic entity, how can we build a general relativistic framework rather than just kind of graphing it in locally? And this is the next kind of argument I'll try to make. It's kind of a pivotal point of the theory. So normally we express time just as this linear thing where we add it in terms of intervals of time together. And these fit together in the real line, and we can put them anywhere in the real line. This is the way we normally think of time adding intervals together. But because we're thinking now that this is an expression for an interval of time, we can also write it as a quadratic form like this over these four kind of intervals of time. And the point being that we are reading this as an expression for proper time. So we're pulling out these components from our interval of time. And because of this arithmetic quadratic structure, this has a geometric interpretation of former three-dimensional space. So we're kind of pulling out this former three-dimensional space from the left-hand side, from our interval of time. And if we take the full four-dimensional expression, this describes a four-dimensional space-time element. And that's because the Lorentz symmetries of this thing applying to these coordinates, passive coordinate transformations map out a light cone geometry. We can also think of this as active Lorentz transformations that map out this kind of hyperbolic rotations or proper time in the forward light cone. So this quadratic structure here, because there's minus sign, it preserves this causal structure of time, but we also pull out a spatial structure at the same time. So the point is that whereas when we had this simple linear thing, these simple intervals here fit together in the line, and we go to this quadratic form of the four components, these things fit together in a patch of R4. So we can either think of that as in the same way that these coordinate intervals here all fit together in the same line. We can think of each of these delta x's fitting together in their own kind of coordinate axis, and this element here can now be anywhere along this line. Similarly, along the other axes, we can think of this as being anywhere along this coordinate line. So these fit together in R4, And more generally, we can think of this as describing geometric elements of a local four-dimensional space-time, which naturally fit together in this four-dimensional space-time structure, which is taken to a continuum limit. So our flow of time itself, by taking out these local quadratic structure, can be expressed kind of intrinsically in four-dimensional space-time form, which preserves its causal properties between events throughout. So the pivotal argument here is that you can use this arithmetic substructure of time, which is just implicit in the nature of the continuum, to express time itself in a geometric form in which it flows, rather than kind of adding time to the geometry somehow. So any trajectory through this space-time now will satisfy this local form. So this can be taken to an extended region of arbitrary size, allowed to full four-dimensional space-time universe any size we want it to be. And the point is that the thing we normally think of as time, perhaps, is just these world lines, are really just elements within this overall structure. The whole thing is a temporal structure, and it contains kind of world lines. These are things that we normally associate with time. The whole thing is temporal. And then things like causal set theory also recognize this central causal property of space-time. It's a central feature of what space-time is. Now, because we're writing this as an expression for a proper time interval, that's at the beginning, we can directly generalize this now, generalize proper time, still pull out our space-time part, but then locally we have these extra parts which we're taking as our matter content. And we follow those mathematical rules through those E6 and E7 symmetries, these directly lead to some of the model-like structures. But what we have now, and then there's a four-dimensional space-time full of these kind of this physics. So what we have is we're constructing this full four-dimensional space-time block. We've built it out of our elements of time. So it contains an everywhere flow of time underlying the evolution of the matter state. So the analogy is, so we're building this four-dimensional space-time block by pulling these components of time out of our flow of space, by pulling out the geometry of space out of these components of time. So what we're kind of marrying together these kind of dynamic elements of flowing time with a block structure of the four-dimensional space-time. There's a kind of analogy with a river here, where when you look at a river, you just see a solid block that doesn't sort of move. It's always there in the same kind of geological feature, but it's always flowing. It's containing the water. It's dynamic, but it's also static. It's a bit similar. We're building our four-dimensional space-time out of the flow of time, essentially. And this is key observation is that the block is associated more with solutions in general relativity, whereas the dynamic flowing aspects are more to do with evolution of state and quantum theory. There's one argument why this framework provides a useful setting for the problem of unifying gravity with quantum theory, because we're unifying together a block four-dimensional space-time structure, this underlying flow as well. Now, I'm not going to talk about this whole branch of the theory which deals with trying to amalgamate and relativity of quantum theory. I'll just say the approach taken is to take, normally people try to take quantum theory as a given thing and try to quantize gravity or quantize space-time in some way, assume that there is a quantum gravity, a quantization of gravity. Here we're doing the opposite. The strategy is to take general relativity quite literally as one space-time, and we're trying to reformulate quantum theory within that setting. So I'm not going to go into the technicalities, I'll just mention it briefly in the next slide, but rather I'll contrast this local construction from local elements. I'll make the contrast and make the point with theory of spectrospatial dimensions. So from four-dimensional space-time with general relativity, the usual approach with extra spatial dimensions is to construct a higher dimensional global space-time structure. This is some complicated thing which is hard to kind of picture, but it's this metric here that's basically the gravitational field, which is kind of generalized in this high dimensional space-time form, and then we compactify down to four-dimensional space-time. So there might be one extra compactified dimension like Clusius and Klein in a five-dimensional space-time, or in string theory it might be some more complicated, might be a manifold type thing, something like that. That's the general strategy of extraspatial dimensions. Here, by contrast, we're coming in at this purely local level, pulling out our local inertial frame, this Lorentz metric here, and we're generalizing these components to a higher order of the proper time, cubic quarter, and a form here, now it's proper time. So this will be powers p greater than 2, as well as more than 4 space-time components. The Lorentz symmetry is augmented to this higher symmetry here, which is then broken when we pull out the local events part, which kind of leaves a kind of residual gauge theory part, the gauge symmetry part, which would be the source of our local gauge symmetries of the theory. And all the residual matter components, so the residual components of this, I'm pulling out fundamental space-time part, they'll give us our matter components transforming under this broken symmetry. So these are alternative means of identifying matter by generalizing the metric character. So extra-spatial dimensions, we go to this high-dimensional space-time and then compact it by down. Here we come straight in at the local level and just generalize this local form and take off the extra components as our form of matter. So just as a comment, when extra-spatial dimensions started with Kaluza and Klein, over years ago, people were trying to unify the gravitational field with the classical electromagnetic field, an extended thing. So it kind of made sense to come in at this global structure because you're looking, these are field components and you want field components to describe your Maxwell field. Now in particle physics, we're really more interested in local particle interactions, local symmetry properties. We do think about all the local structure of matter, the local structure of particles. So whereas in extra-spatial dimensions, this is a very indirect way of going to a higher dimensional space and then compacted by now to local structure. Here we just start as the local structure and we stay there to get these kind of properties of matter. So it's a more direct way of getting to these local kind of matter properties. And we then build up this four-dimensional space-time from the local elements. And that geometry will depend upon the nature of these residual gauge symmetries and residual components. So we're building up the geometry, the Einstein tensor, as a function of matter fields and gauge fields. And that, again, will define our energy momentum on the right-hand side, reading this equation more from right to left. So in contrast to the extra-spatial dimensions, we begin with a global space-time and compactify down. And there's typically a huge ambiguity in matter types, depending on how you form these caviar manifolds and compactify down. So you might end up with a rather bad form of uniqueness after appeal to some kind of multiverse or anthropic principle or something like that. Here, we get the matter locally, and this matter looks a lot like standard model when we do these kind of symmetry breaking structures for E6 and E7. And then we build up the external four-dimensional space. And so our ambiguity comes in, and there's a vast degeneracy of matter contributions. And so the matter types are fixed by the symmetry breaking, but the actual components of which matter fields we use and how they interact together, there is an ambiguity in that. But that's in the theory taken to underlie indeterminacy in quantum theory. And so in this equation here, general relativity comes in as the overall equation, as a field equation, and locally, quantum theory comes in from the degeneracy of the matter fields underlying the same geometry. That's the idea, building up this theory that builds in quantum theory and gravity together. So in principle, that's a good form of uniqueness because we have to account for indeterminacy in quantum theory. As a final topic, I'll quickly describe, oh, that's the paper. Yeah, it's all written up. But all of these things I've talked about are written up in the papers on the item. As a final topic, I'll just describe how this belief theory also contains a dark set. To get there, I'll make a more direct comparison, again, with this approach of extra-spatial dimensions, comparing it with this approach of generalizing proper time at the local level, doing head-to-head, head-to-head comparison with extra-spatial dimensions by looking what happens to extra-spatial dimensions falling out at the local level. So we kind of do the same thing, the extra-spatial dimensions coming at the local level, where we extend out space-time form of this quadratic form, proper time interval here, rather than extending the proper time itself. So what I mentioned before is that if we go to p greater than 2 powers, and this is what leads to, say, for example, this quartic form, over 56 components, which had this E7 symmetry, which we broke down, and it had all these kind of standard model properties, electron-weak symmetry breaking type properties, and the prediction going on to E8 to get the full standard model. So that's what happens when we generalize proper time. But we could do a parallel analysis with extra-spatial dimensions at the local level, which is just in this quadratic form, but we can still do the same local symmetry breaking kind of thing. So what happens in this case? So say here, rather than breaking the E7 symmetry, we're breaking this larger Lorentz symmetry. If we do the symmetry breaking, we pull out our external four vector part here. And the residual part is now a scalar field transforming under this residual rotation symmetry here. So the point being that if you do the simplest possible thing, the extra-spatial dimensions, this looks like nothing whatsoever like the standard model. It's just getting scalar particles, you don't get spin states, you don't get things like these gauge groups, SU3 or U1, you just get an SOM, nothing at all like standard model. So that's why generalizing proper time is far, far better suited to some of my monolithic structures. But at the same time, in a way, we got to this form here by augmenting this four-dimensional space-time form. And this is a kind of a special case for generalizing proper time. So why can't we just say this is generalized proper time? Because we're adding on components, it's not shifting to the four-dimensional the case. So yes, this is a form of generalizing proper time. So what is the physics of this? Well, here the internal gauge symmetry is just in parallel with the standard model kind of gauge symmetries. So it's hidden from the standard model sector. We've got these two independent gauge sectors. So there's no gauge interactions between this matter and this matter. This forms a natural candidate. I call it dark quarks here, even though they're scalars. But this forms a natural candidate for a kind of hidden QCD, compact non-abelian gauge group. So there are many models about hidden QCD type dark matter, which can form kind of blue ball or dark hadron type states. And in fact, it forms a candidate for self-interacting dark matter because there's some interaction between these states. So these are kind of dark, but because they have the same basis in the same four-dimensional space-time, there is a gravitational interaction between them. So there is a gravitational interaction between these two sectors, which might make a natural dark matter candidate. There's a possibility of a Higgs portal, since the Higgs is closely connected to these particles, but the theory is not well enough developed for that. So this just raises the question, how many other ways might there be to generalize proper time? And I'll mention finally one last topic of physics, one other possible sector. So to get to this E7, what I did right at the beginning of the talk was to go from this quadratic structure to a 3x3 matrix structure, and then introduce the octonions to get this 27 component form with an E6 symmetry, and then we extended that over to an E7 quartic form, and did the symmetry breaking structure to get out of the standard model I talked about. That was the first part of the talk. But what we could have done as a form of generalized proper time, what we could have done when we went to the 3x3 matrix, we could have just gone to a 4x4 matrix. This gives us an alternative quartic form for generalizing proper time. There's no reason to stop there. We could go to a 5x5 matrix, 3x3 matrix in general. So this is another sector for generalizing proper time. And what does this look like? So it's just a generalized proper time. So we can do the same symmetry breaking trick here, where we pull out our external four-dimensional space time and ask what the matter particles look like now. So again, we've got this independent internal gauge symmetry from our standard model kind of visible sector over here. So the question is, what are the properties of this kind of gauge sector? So I'm just going to pull out this table on the next slide and say a little bit about it. So the new feature occurs for this sector of generalizing proper time is that this gauge group here, which I initially thought was problematic, because it's what's called a non-compact gauge group. It's not like an ISSO or SU gauge group for the standard model. It contains it's a non-compact gauge group, which means it contains in the quantum theory, you'll have negative energy, kinetic energy states, as well as positive energy, which is normally a worrying thing. Because anything that interacts with a negative energy state, which would be created out of the vacuum, and it would be very unstable. So about 5 years ago, I was following a few cosmology conferences online, and there was a talk on dark energy, and one slide on something called phantom dark energy, and the words negative kinetic energy came up on the screen, and it comes from a scalar model. So there are actually dark energy models that use negative kinetic energy. And people worry about it a little bit in phantom models, because if you've got these negative energy scalar states here, they can always interact by gravitons and generate kind of standard model states out of the vacuum. So the whole thing will just explode and go mad unless you can somehow suppress this. I briefly mentioned it in the theory that talking about here, when we unify gravity with quantum theory, gravity is a classical theory. There aren't any gravitons. So in principle, this diagram does not exist for these negative energy states, but there is an equivalent diagram, which is these self-interactions in this non-abelian gauge theory. So you could create these negative and positive gauge bosons, etc., out of the vacuum. So at first sight, this looks quite bad. But then actually, this would just fill the vacuum, and they'd also annihilate each other, so you can create this kind of stable equilibrium. And by doing a kind of parallel analysis of phantom dark energy models, which are scalar models, we can follow what happens to the energy density and the pressure density. And there's a complete symmetry between the positive and the negative energy contribution. So in principle, the energy density of this thing is zero. The pressure is zero on all macroscopic scales. So we just won't know it. So this room could be filled with this kind of vacuum, positive and negative gauge bosons in this dark sector. There's no interaction other than gravitational with us, and it's gravitationally negligible because it sort of just cancels out. Apart from the fact that there are also these kind of matter states on down this side here. So these introduce an asymmetric perturbation. So in principle, you can now get a vacuum equation, which would give you something like a cosmological constant and something like a dark energy expansion. So I won't go through the details, but I'll just kind of flash up. If you look at the general properties that you look for in dark energy, then qualitatively, this is kind of uniform in space and time. So as the universe expands, it's still being created out of the vacuum. So it kind of fills the universe as it expands. And we've got a source of negative pressure from these negative energy contributions. There's a source of ultra-low energy density coming from this kind of cancellation and slight perturbation. And in principle, although it's not clear, it would be stable and dark because it may only be a gravitational interaction comes from a fundamental theory. So it's a possibility of a possible dark energy candidate. And there is a kind of possible way of testing this eventually. This comes from those cosmology conferences on Zoom a few years ago. And a lot of talk about using the structure of the early universe as a possible source of structure formation in the galaxy. So here, if these processes are happening with plus or minus energy creation in the early universe, this would lead to local energy fluctuations, which if they are kind of expanded by some kind of dark inflation source, this could be frozen into the space-time geometry and seed kind of formation of galaxies later on. This is a standard idea that something in the physics of the very early universe could have seeded kind of galactic formations later on. This is a transition to kind of dark matter states. So this is called something like the cosmological collider, cosmological bootstrap. So bootstrap means that you're using constraints of the early universe, symmetries that kind of constrain what the physics can look like. Cosmological collider, because in principle, at very early universe, you're getting to very high energies, so you can reach higher energies than in particle physics. This is a bit of a nostalgia. There's an event from 30 years ago when I was at SLD. Right in the middle is the SLD vertex detector, which was constructed here at Rutherford Lab 30-odd years ago. But that's a different talk. Here I'm trying to say that in these kind of processes at E plus E minus collider going to quarks, you have this kind of gluons and quarks being produced, these kind of stringy-like structures. If this is going on in the early universe, you've got this positive energy gauge bosons and positive energy quark-like particles coming out, whereas negative energy. So if this is happening in the very early universe and then gets stretched out, this in principle could see things like cosmic wall or cosmic web structures. And there's also a signature coming from negative energy kind of production, which could be said to be voids. But my point is that when people look at these cosmological collider and bootstrap kind of approaches, usually the physics is very different to this. So because the physics signature is quite different, in principle, this is a way something like this might be tested. So I'm going to head towards summing up now, and I'm going to get there by a kind of a short story from Heisenberg. I read this in a small volume from A Life of Physics, and it's reprinted lectures. This is a lecture that Heisenberg gave in the late 60s in Italy at a conference on contemporary physics about his life in physics. And at the end of his lecture, he described a story from his childhood where he was building a box. Now, Heisenberg's box is not for accommodating Schrodinger's cat, as you might think. He was building it to keep books and things in. So it's probably the early 1910s. And as he describes making this box, he got to put the lid on and he took the first nail and he just bashed the nail in really hard. And when he bashed this nail in, he was kind of disappointed that on all the banging, it kind of come displaced from where it was supposed to be. We all had this kind of experience at some point. So as Heisenberg tells the story, his grandfather, who was a handicraftsman, was watching on. He said, "No, you don't do it like that. Take that nail out. What you should do is get all the nails together and tap them all in a little bit. And then when you've got everything quite secure, then you should stop bashing things in probably when you've got everything nicely lined up." This, of course, is his analogy for his approach to physics. And it's a warning about running in too quickly with kind of rigorous mathematics. When you try too much for rigorous mathematical methods, you get too attached to those points of mathematics rather than the physics. And you should have the whole picture in mind before you fix the theory too firmly in mathematics. So, of course, you do need the rigorous mathematics, but the point is that by solving big puzzles in mathematics, it's great for mathematics, doesn't necessarily mean you're solving problems in physics. It's just about getting the physics picture in place and then kind of working out with the details through that rigorous mathematics. So in the modern day, unified theory is a bit like this. We need the right kind of conceptual foundations, issues with the standard model, there's issues of quantum gravity, and then issues in cosmology. And we want all of these things to kind of come together, basically, and then kind of listen at the theory. So to properly sum up, we've got two, I'm going to just sum up. Yeah. So this approach to analyze proper time works very well. And I think the kind of take-home message here is probably, I think it doesn't work well for the big, but the main obstacle is that we think we can't possibly build theory constructing the whole world out of time. It's just too simple. I mean, there's not enough structure in time to build this thing. But on the other side of this obstacle, it's kind of obvious that time provides a natural unifying basis because, well, I mean, everything happens in time. There's something kind of universal about time. I mean, everything happens in time. If you can find a way of constructing a theory out of time, then it's automatically just a very unifying approach. There's a kind of changing worldview. It's quite a big changing worldview. Just this, a lot of people quote this from Einstein, that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. So there is this general feeling in physics that, because it's much quoted, that people are looking for a very simple theory, a very simple idea. So here, the trick is to see how it's possible to construct a theory just some time. So I'm just going to go through, summarize this, just this argument for how you can build a theory from time, just as a kind of a take-home message maybe to think about. And the barrier is that we normally think of time as a one-dimensional line in space, or a line in space-time. Obviously, there's nothing in the world that really corresponds to the vanishing thin line that sort of follows around. It's not really what time is. But if we're just taking time as a continuum, then this says nothing about spatial extension whatsoever. So we have to forget about time as line in space. And see time a bit like we see three-dimensional space and intrinsically for what it is without anything missing. And the way I sometimes think about this is like listening to a flow of a piece of music in a dark place or where you're not thinking about space, just a sense of a flow in time. Well, we can describe this flow mathematically by the real numbers. And the key point is that real numbers, we can't just add them and subtract them, but we can also multiply them, divide them, take roots and so on. So if we're treating time as a continuum and the real numbers have these properties, then it means that time itself has these intrinsic properties. This is the key point. So that if we can write, we can write time as just adding together, just using these plus and minus properties, the way we usually think of time. But we can also, and they do fit together, we normally think of the continuum of time. But we can also express a real interval using these other properties of the real numbers, in, for example, this quadratic form like this, and we can pull out the structure of space from this structure of time, which has a geometric interpretation, the whole thing having an interpretation, so this minor sign having a causal kind of light kind of structure. In the same way that these simple elements here fit together in a line, we normally think of time, these quadratic elements, because of this geometric interpretation, these fit together in a four-dimensional space-time world, which can be taken to a continuum limit, which have this local light kind of structure, local inertial reference to light general relativity. So the idea is that the arithmetic subtractive type contains a geometric form from which it flows. This is a final slide. So we can then construct this extended four-dimensional space type just out of this flow of time. So there's two stages to get here. One is to forget of time as being a line, just think of it as a continuum, like listening to the piece of music, and then recognizing this internal structure of time, which has this geometric interpretation. So the whole thing is a temporal structure, and it contains these kind of these world lines. But the point is that we're reading this from left to right. So there's even an argument here of the reason why the world is relativistic. Is because we're starting with time and we're kind of pulling the components of space out of this continuum of time, which is what links space and time together in the space-time form. And if we're pulling these components out of this flow of time, we can also extend this to high-dimensional forms, which is how we get these structures of matter coming out here. So this gives us our matter content in the space-time. This change in perspective from time being something like a world line or whatever it is, a parameter in the world, the world being something in time. Now, to sort of get matter and space out of time may sound a bit strange because time and matter are strange. Time and space and matter are different things. But already in relativity, for 100 years, we mix up matters. We mix up time and space components in relativity. And in the theory of extra-spatial dimensions, we mix up space and matter. So We already have theories which mix up time and matter and space components. So what was involved here is a rewiring of these interplay between time and space and matter in a manner which is more streamlined and by construction more more unifying. And it sounds like we're doing a lot by trying to pull space and matter out of just a time. Well, the whole point of unification is to get as much as possible out of as little as possible. This is arguably as far as you can go and try to pull out really unifying kind of picture. And in through this construction, you unify together this lock and dynamic because it provides this kind of basis for quantum gravity, as I briefly mentioned, by looking at degeneracy of components in this construction. And when you actually look at the matter content, when you take this generalized form of proper time and you break it over fundamental space time, there is a sector which is richer than the model, and it leads to a prediction this EA structure gets full through the generation side model. But there are also these other sectors which have properties like compact gauge groups for dark matter, and also this negative energy contribution, a bit like phantom dark energy, as a vacuum dark energy state for dark energy. And it all comes together under one unifying equation, one simple equation, which is another feature sometimes sought for unification. Also, I think quite often when you're breaking down matter, looking trying to get more elementary structure of matter from, say, visible matter to microscopic matter, to molecular or atomic matter, to have the standard models, as far as you can always say, what is that made out of? You get into a smaller level. Here, we're starting simply with time, and you might say, well, what's time made out of? We can't really break up time any further. It's precisely by recognizing this intrinsic arithmetic kind of substructure. We're already decomposing time itself. It's by decomposing time we pull out this space and matter components. So by getting down to the simplest level and already decomposing it, we're getting down to some kind of bedrock level of the bare bones of what we could build a theory out of. So again, maybe as you might seek for unification, it's getting down to some real kind of bedrock level. And of course, it might sound implausible, but by its very implausibility, it's also very constraining what you can do. So it's quite striking that when you do drag out properties of matter in space-time from this, it actually hits these three targets for unification in terms of standard model-like structures, quantum gravity and dark sectors, fairly well. So I think if anybody, whether experimentist or theory, interested in unification, because of the general kind of motivation for this in general terms and how well it hits the targets for unification, I think it's worth considering something like this approach of generalizing proper time or something quite similar to that. So yeah, thanks very much for that.
Thank you very much, David. Yes, we have time for questions.
I've loved the idea since I heard you first say it about 15 years ago. I find it interesting when you were saying about the maths, the physics and the maths and where they come together. Because what I feel like your basic point is we should look at the structure of the continuum or the source of the structure reality. Like, so I love that you're sort of starting with the physics end, like, right? Do you think coming at it from what is, because, you know, like the continuum has like points in it that I think could be rich for your quantization, like the rationals, for example, are a special set of points in the continuum. That's almost like a quantization of the continuum.
Right, several points there.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way we often introduce the real numbers of continuum, we often get this, we learn about integers first in steps, and then we learn about fraction and rational numbers. And then we realize that when you try to say, like Pythagoras, when you try to draw a triangle with side one there and side one, what's the length of the hypotenuse? It's square root of two. And you can't write that as a fraction anymore. So you need something else. And so often the real numbers are introduced as kind of filling in the gaps kind of thing of fraction and so on, rational numbers. That, in my view, that's the wrong way of looking at the real continuum. The continuum is something that stands in itself. And there are, I think, some mathematical definitions of the continuum get there directly. And the continuum isn't really something made out of points, it's made out of the continuum. But the smallest, no matter how far down you go, you still have elements. So when you say about points of quantization, well, my view is on that, and I haven't really talked about some of the theory, is that because it's such a simple idea, so elementary, so constraining, that quantization type things come out from those constraints ultimately. Well,
yeah, exactly. I don't think you should be quantizing something. You should be having quantization.
I think it's a very, very constraining way of kind of building stuff.
Yeah. But on the points thing, I kind of think the continuum is pristine. Those are like dividing points. They're not like what the continuum is made out of, but they're points where it can be divided.
Yeah, I mean, you can introduce points into the continuum. Yeah, but I mean, there are different ways of looking at it. But I used to think of the continuum being made out of points, kind of what it is, but then you get all this kind of, sort of levels of infinity and so
on.
But I think the continuum, and the way it's used in practice in all that, ever since like the Newtonian mechanics, I mean, you always use calculus and that kind of element of the continuum, being able to use differential calculus to do dynamics and using equations, Maxwell's equations. But all of these things use the continuum. It's that property of the continuum. So that's why it's kind of quite conservative theory, probably using these continuum property of time, but rather than using it as an independent variable and differentiating things with respect to that continuum variable, we're using the fact that we can decompose this continuum itself, derive structures of matter.
Yeah, and that's what the thing I found fascinating from the start is that just from that simple thing, you end up with structures that contain standard model.
You can almost kind of just introduce this as a mathematical ansatz and run it to the mathematical side and just develop it purely as a mathematical theory as a place to remember that. That's not the way I got into it. I mean, I think of all these conceptual relations between space and matter, but because once you get this equation, then it's all about the mathematical development of the theory after that. And it is quite, I mean, I think the sticking point is so counterintuitive that you can get so much out of so little, but that is the point of the unification.
Yeah, I didn't really get the idea until 5 years after the first talk I sat on. One thing that really helped me is to realize that how energy relates, because like energy is the noise of charge of time.
So, this is what's happening.
Energy is being the noise of charge of time, right?
Oh.
So, if me and someone else are measuring time slightly differently because of the coefficients we've got, we see energy differently and there's an asymmetry there, and that's why if I run into them, it hurts because we're measuring time differently, so therefore our energies are asymmetric.
Think about that.
That was when it clicked. So this is the most general form you can write.
I'm taking these alpha coefficients right down to the zeros of plus or minus ones as generalization of this structure. And that's because, I suppose originally I was thinking of writing it, if you write it explicitly, there aren't any kind of coefficients which aren't sort of invented, if you like. It's just an arithmetic expression without any other coefficients in there. When you've got kind of permutation over different possible indices and so on, that when you write it in short form, this could be various sort of integer numbers and so on. But the question, I have not classified how many possible ways it is explicitly possible to decompose. I mean, I know that there are at least these three possible ways, for example. So I mean, I haven't systematically thought about how many others there are. And there are various other kind of caveats here. So, for example, I mentioned this is like a compact gauge group you get from these SON groups for dark matter. But you could make this also the generalization to having what in the context of extra kind of spatial dimensions would be extra time dimensions, where this would also have a non-compact component. So you could end up having like a dark energy sector in here as well. So both of these sectors, in fact, could contain what are like a compact gauge group and a non-compact gauge group. That's what I meant a little bit I said about dark matter and dark energy interacting, because it might actually both contain dark matter and dark energy. So yes, there are various other generalizations, but I haven't categorized it. I mean, these are the ones that stand out as being this sort of ones, or the ones that came up when I was. But it is, to me it's quite striking that it is very restrictive what you can do. But these viewpoints on the model like structures, and these do have qualitative features that you look for in dark matter and dark energy. And then in that kind of cosmological pie chart of visible matter, dark matter, dark energy, we see these three sectors very differently. These three phenomenologically completely different things, but they all come out the sectors of this thing is quite striking to me. Not working at this, you know. Certainly, the point is here that this doesn't just provide a framework in which you can hang these things on, which is often the case in the translation I mentioned, if you're Alex with fields or pseudosymmetry Alex. So in that framework, translation is here, everything is coming directly out of the theory. That's why partly I wanted to see it's possible to derive, you know, quantum theory in this quantum gravity context rather than just quantizing things, just to, since it's the first go for this, to see what comes out. As I mentioned, relativity kind of comes out, because we're dragging spatial components out of time consistent with causality. That's what links time and space together in relativity. So we're trying to get as much out as we can rather than sort of putting anything written by hand, sort of.
I think it's already almost time.
It's almost time. Yes.
Yeah, so we can continue discussions for lunch.
We can join for lunch. We are going, David. So we close the seminar now. Thanks for everyone.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, but my daughter's first cricket game. An hour away.
Also,
three.
Thanks for coming. Passing the main idea.
Yeah.
It wasn't too technical. There were quite a bit of equations, but yeah. I think you did a very, very nice job.
For PPD, it's quite hardcore theory.
For PPD.
I wanted to show that there were some maths in there. I wanted to make everything up.
I think you were just in there to assist with every line of equation. So while talking, you made
best
it
explanations are
easier.
Okay.
If you can vary your, how the ancient Greeks.
There was multi.
Different thought was angry.
Yes.
Whereas our explanation, if you're changing the aspect of it, it breaks.
Uh-huh.
Explain the phenomenon. So this is why I love Dave's idea, because you can't change anything. You're just saying, what's the structure of an infinitesimal piece of time?
Yeah.
You don't put anything else in.
Well, the